current, and that is the force of human freedom.
President George W. Bush delivering his second inaugural address in January of 2005. The president's call to end tyranny and promote freedom around the world was sharply criticized abroad, but very well received by America's neoconservatives. Since September 11th, many observers in the United States and around the world have pointed to the neoconservatives as the leading force behind the Bush administration's push for war in Iraq, its ambitious effort to spread democracy in the Muslim world, and its unabashed use of America's power abroad. On this edition of America Abroad, we examine the meaning of neoconservatism, its history, and its impact on American foreign policy. To begin, I'm joined by John Micklethwaite, U.S. editor of The Economist. John, you're based in London. In your view, how well do Europeans understand what American neoconservatism is and what influence it's had on the Bush administration since 9/11?
I think Europeans, on the whole, don't understand neoconservatism very well. They have very little idea of the history of it. They have very little idea that these were originally Democrats who changed to the other side of the political spectrum. And they tend to have somewhat clichéd views of just how powerful the neoconservatives are within Bush's world. And so they've become a sort of bogeyman for a lot of Europeans, often wrongly, I think.
Clichéd how?
I think their clichéd version of a neoconservative is someone who's obsessively pro-Israel, who is pushed very much towards a preemptive war at virtually all possible opportunities, and also the idea that they're very sort of hard right-wingers. And I think in many of those instances, there are exaggerations there.
How do you explain the role of American neoconservatives in the conservative movement to a European audience?
I think the answer is with great difficulty. Neoconservatives and the religious right are sort of two groups of people they find it very difficult to get their hands around. I think they find the idealism, if I can put it that word, of the neoconservatives slightly frightening. You could run into a lot of French politicians, a lot of German politicians, who tend to see neoconservatives either as sort of mad and dangerous, or is just downright naive, and often a mixture of all those things at once. And in particular, they take the attitude that, look, it's much, much more difficult to bring about change in the Arab world than the neoconservatives put forward. The world, they insist, is always much more complicated than the neoconservatives make out. The neoconservatives reply, you've got it wrong, by following years of trying to appease Islamic terrorism as they see it. You have actually betrayed your starting point.
Well, a few prominent neocons have left the Bush administration. In your view, will the neocons be less influential in the second term?
I think they will be slightly less influential, to the extent that, as you pointed out, some of their more senior people have left, but with two pretty strong caveats. The first is that their influence in the first Bush term was, I think, always pretty exaggerated. The most senior neocon, Paul Wolfowitz, was number two to Donald Rumsfeld. You do not have to spend more than about 10 minutes with Donald Rumsfeld to realize that if you are number two with Donald Rumsfeld, you are a long way down the pecking order. The second point is that the neoconservatives, still dominate the market for ideas about foreign policy. They're still the people coming out with the most ideas about which way American foreign policy should go. So even though the personnel have gone, the ideas still remain, and if you're Bush, you're Cheney, you're Rumsfeld, you're Rice, you're still turning to the neoconservatives for ideas about how exactly to push American foreign policy.
John Micklethwaite is U.S. editor of The Economist and author of The Right Nation. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The word neoconservative may be widely known around the world today, but the real meaning and history of neoconservatism is not. The neoconservatives have been an influential movement in American intellectual and political life since at least the 1960s. And as America Abroad's Garrick Utley explains, they've remained influential because they offer an ambitious, if controversial, answer to an age-old problem in America's foreign policy: how to unite America's power with its principles.
Ever since I can remember, I've been a neo-something, a neo-Marxist, a neo-Trotskyist, a neo-liberal, a neo-conservative.
That's Irving Kristol, a prominent 20th century intellectual and a founding father of neoconservatism. As he said, the story of what are today's neoconservatives begins on the far left among Marxists and Trotskyites in 1930s America.
Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread?
It was a time when the Depression crippled American industry and America's capitalist system seemed to be in deep trouble.
Brother, can you spare a dime?
Franklin Roosevelt voiced the common fears in his inaugural address in 1933.
The savings of many years in thousands of families are gone. A host of unemployed citizens face the grim problem of existence, and an equally great number toil with little return. Only a foolish optimist can deny the dark realities of the moment.
The founders of neoconservatism were a group of Jewish New York intellectuals. They were idealists, and during the early 1930s, they believed in the utopian promise of communism. But confronted by evidence of Stalin's purges and show trials in the Soviet Union, neoconservatives soon understood that communism was a danger because it contained the seeds of totalitarianism and terror.
I may say that I got along fine with Marshal Stalin. I believe he is truly representative of the heart and soul of Russia. And I believe that we are going to get along very well with him and the Russian people. Very well indeed.
President Roosevelt speaking in 1943. In World War II, the young neoconservatives saw America's military power used in a noble cause to rid the world of fascism and then build democracy in Germany and Japan. But during the war, Roosevelt often downplayed the differences between democracy and Soviet communism.
They tell us that millions of Italian citizens will vote communist and socialist on April 18th, but they don't tell us why.
Disagreements within the Democratic Party burst into the open in the 1948 presidential campaign, and the left wing of the Democratic Party supported the more radical views of Roosevelt's former vice president, Henry Wallace.
They don't tell us that we have already spent $2 billion to maintain the unsound economic system of Italy, to enable private American oil firms to gain control of the Italian oil industry.
But Truman beat back the challenge from the Wallace side. The Democratic Party came together around a policy of containment of the Soviet Union and support for America's global leadership. The neoconservatives remained staunch Democrats and strong liberals on domestic policy. But in foreign affairs, they advocated tough anti-Soviet policies in the emerging Cold War and supported President Harry Truman.
The seeds of totalitarian regimes are nurtured by misery and want. The free peoples of the world look to us for support in maintaining their freedom. If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world.
The combination of liberal policies at home and anti-communism abroad would remain a mainstream position in the Democratic Party for two decades. In the 1960 presidential campaign, John F. Kennedy criticized the Republican administration of Dwight Eisenhower for weakness in the face of a Soviet military and economic buildup.
The question is whether the world will exist, half slave or half free, whether it will move in the direction of freedom or whether it will move in the direction of slavery.
But Kennedy's vision and the unity of the Democratic Party on foreign policy would soon collapse amidst the turmoil of the 1960s and the Vietnam War. It began with student groups protesting on university campuses against what they saw as the injustices in the American system. Berkeley student leader Mario Savio in 1964.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop.
The future neoconservatives saw the protests and the violence in America's cities as a threat to the fundamental values and institutions of American democracy. Their fears intensified when the counterculture and student movement turned their anger and agitation against the Vietnam War and accused the United States of being a malevolent and dangerous force in the world.
This was the nomination day that the hippies, the yippies, and other demonstrators promised that Chicago would not quickly forget. Thousands of long-haired, sandaled youths marched into Grant Park across Michigan Avenue from the Conrad Hilton Hotel.
That was 1968, the year the Democrats held their national convention in Chicago. With the protests and violence at the convention, liberal anti-communists like Irving Kristol and Jean Kirkpatrick felt alienated from the values and foreign policies of their party. The new left wing in the Democratic Party called these disaffected Democrats neoconservatives, implying that they had more in common with Republicans than with Democrats.
I do not know how to assess the Soviet Union except as an opportunistic, unpredictable, and dangerous opponent.
In an effort to restore what they saw as the true Democratic Party, the neoconservatives soon pinned their hopes on a Democratic Senator, Henry Scoop Jackson. The neoconservatives backed Jackson in his run for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1972, but the Democrats nominated George McGovern, whose opposition to the Vietnam War and campaign slogan, "Come Home, America," deeply disturbed the neoconservatives. They soon found another Democrat who echoed their values in foreign policy.
This General Assembly was a disaster. A working majority of Muslim and communist countries decided to continue the practice of using their votes to assert hostile propositions about the West. The West was the target in Western liberal democracy.
In a time of self-doubt and the loss of Vietnam, U.N. Ambassador Daniel Patrick Moynihan captivated the neoconservatives and many Americans with a strong defense of democracy and Western values. Moynihan would later run and win a Senate seat in New York, but the neoconservatives were looking for someone who could become a leader of the Democratic Party and even win the presidency.
But our national security in this complicated age requires more than just military might.
When Scoop Jackson failed in a second bid for the Democratic nomination in 1976, he endorsed Jimmy Carter, as did many neoconservatives. But they would be greatly disappointed by the new president.
In such a world, the choice is not which superpower will dominate the world. We have no desire to be the world's policeman.
For many neoconservatives, the Democrats could no longer be counted on to protect America's security. In 1980, they turned to a Republican presidential candidate, Ronald Reagan. Like them, he had begun as a Democrat and as an admirer of Franklin Roosevelt.
If the rest of this century is to witness the gradual growth of freedom and democratic ideals, we must take actions to assist the campaign for democracy.
Several neoconservatives joined the Reagan administration and supported the president as he led a massive buildup of U.S. military power. And they applauded his bold speeches and called for America to promote the values of democracy around the world.
Let us now begin a crusade for freedom that will engage the faith and fortitude of the next generation.
By the end of Reagan's first term, several neoconservatives had become central figures in the foreign policy of a Republican administration. But during his second term, Reagan used America's growing military and economic strength to negotiate with the Soviet Union to pursue his idealistic hopes to abolish nuclear weapons and achieve a lasting peace. Reagan addressed the nation before traveling to Geneva to meet with the new Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev.
My mission, stated simply, is a mission for peace. It is to engage the new Soviet leader in what I hope will be a dialogue for peace that endures beyond my presidency.
The neoconservatives opposed Reagan's embrace of Gorbachev, but Reagan held firm, and the Cold War ended on American terms. Neoconservatives believed that Ronald Reagan's willingness to provide moral clarity, backed by American power, had made victory possible.
The Clinton administration's on-again, off-again bomb the Serbs policy is, as Dan said, on-again, but there is much confusion here over how or even when all this talk really turns into U.S. airstrikes.
But with the Cold War over, the neoconservatives, like everyone else, struggled to articulate new principles to guide America in a world without a totalitarian threat. The Clinton administration wavered on the use of force in Bosnia, and the neoconservatives were also divided about whether American power should be deployed for largely humanitarian ends. But in the 1990s, a new generation of neoconservatives, led by Irving Kristol's son Bill Kristol, began to articulate a new set of principles. They called for a neo-Reaganite foreign policy built around a large increase in America's defense budget, support for democracy abroad, and bold American leadership in the world. These efforts, though, did not attract much support within the Democratic or Republican parties, until...
Just before 9 a.m. Eastern, Americans awaken to shocking pictures from New York.
September 11, 2001.
I just saw the entire top part of the World Trade Center explode.
The neoconservatives saw Islamic radicalism and dictators like Saddam Hussein as the new totalitarian threat of our time, and they argued that the promotion of democracy was the ultimate cure for Middle East terrorism. Their vision would resonate with America's new president, George W. Bush.
The world has a clear interest in the spread of democratic values because stable and free nations do not breed the ideologies of murder. A new regime in Iraq would serve as a dramatic and inspiring example of freedom for other nations in the region.
The war in Iraq was seen around the world as a reflection of the power of the neoconservatives in the Bush administration.
The statue is starting to topple. It's coming forward. And now it falls. And the statue, the hollow statue of Saddam, is left dangling from this marble plinth.
Soon after Saddam Hussein's fall, the deep and violent divisions in Iraq ended any hope for a quick withdrawal of American troops. In the face of mounting criticism at home and abroad, the neoconservatives and the president stuck to their principles and policy and argued that events in Iraq and the Middle East would ultimately vindicate their approach. After his re-election, President Bush laid out his new vision. It was reminiscent of John F. Kennedy's inaugural and close to the hearts of the neoconservatives.
Americans of all people should never be surprised by the power of our ideals. Eventually, the call of freedom comes to every mind and every soul. We do not accept the existence of permanent tyranny because we do not accept the possibility of permanent slavery. Liberty will come to those who love it.
President George W. Bush delivering his second inaugural address in January 2005. What is the future of the neoconservatives? Will neoconservative ideas prove to be an enduring force in America's foreign policy? Or will it turn out to have been a brief and failed attempt to join American values to military power? The Bush administration's success in bringing democracy to Iraq and the Middle East will go a long way to answering that question. I'm Garrick Utley for America Abroad.
Next on the program, we look back at one of the neoconservative movement's heroes, Senator Henry Scoop Jackson.
His view, and he used to recite it again and again, was that the communists were like burglars walking down a hotel room corridor, that they would try each door, and if it was open, they'd go in.
And we'll hear about disputes within the neoconservative movement over the war against Iraq. Stay tuned to America Abroad. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad.
You are back inside the church now, and you have seen the senator's casket, flag-draped casket, at the front of the sanctuary. Almost half the Senate arrived here at First Presbyterian Church, then in what must be described, it leaves me almost speechless. It is an incredible tribute to this man, Henry Jackson, Vice President...
Scenes from the funeral of Senator Henry Scoop Jackson, who died in 1983. Many neoconservatives point to two men as their greatest heroes and inspirations. One was President Ronald Reagan, and the other, Scoop Jackson, a Democrat and a senator from the state of Washington. Jackson served 43 years in Congress with the Democratic Party, spanning the administrations of 8 different presidents. A surprising number of today's neoconservatives either worked for or advised Scoop Jackson, including Richard Perle, Elliot Abrams, Paul Wolfowitz, and Gene Kirkpatrick. As America Abroad's Steve Roberts explains, not everyone agrees about the relationship between Jackson's views and the neoconservatism of today, but both his legacy and the way it's been interpreted tell us much about neoconservatism then and now.
Henry Jackson was born in a town called Everett in the state of Washington, the son of Norwegian immigrants. His sister nicknamed him Scoop after the comic book character who had a talent for avoiding household chores. Jackson was a liberal Democrat on domestic issues throughout his career. James Schlesinger served as Secretary of Defense and Director of the CIA during the Nixon administration and was a close colleague whom Jackson admired.
He was a New Dealer. We talk about old Democrats and new Democrats, and Scoop was an old Democrat.
Jackson was elected to the House of Representatives in 1940 and served during World War II, a war that was to profoundly shape his outlook on international affairs. Former Speaker of the House Tom Foley, also a native Washingtonian, worked as a congressional staffer for Jackson before launching his own congressional career.
In the process of seeing what Nazi power could do and how cruel totalitarian states could become, I think he developed a strong notion that the United States must never be at the mercy of totalitarian or other powers, and that the first responsibility of the United States was to protect freedom at home and to encourage the spread of freedom and democracy abroad.
Richard Pearl is one of today's most well-known neoconservatives, and he worked as an aide to Scoop Jackson for 11 years.
Scoop believed that to see how a country might deal with us, you had to look at how they dealt with their own people. And for Scoop, the totalitarian character of that society meant that they were a danger to us.
James Schlesinger agrees that Scoop Jackson saw totalitarianism as a danger. But Schlesinger does not believe that Scoop shared Woodrow Wilson's idealism about the need to spread democracy.
If Scoop were a Wilsonian, I think he would have mentioned Woodrow Wilson sometime in the course of the 15 or 18 years that he and I were associated. No, he was not a Wilsonian. He was ultimately a pragmatist.
For much of his career, Jackson was a very close supporter of Israel. Jackson's support for Israel was deeply rooted in his family background and his experiences in World War II. Tom Foley.
His mother was very influential in instructing Scoop that the rights of others had to be respected, and was particularly offended when somebody in the neighborhood yelled at a Jewish peddler and called him a kike. And she told Scoop how outrageous that was.
You've got to remember that Scoop, at the close of World War II, had visited the concentration camps in Germany, and that had an immense impact on him.
After five terms in the House, Jackson was elected to the Senate in 1952. During the 50s, he established himself as an authority on national security, who supported a strong U.S. military and a vigorous anti-communism. During the Kennedy administration, Jackson's views on foreign policy were uncontroversial, and even mainstream positions in the Democratic Party. But the tumultuous years of the 1960s and the Vietnam War changed the face of America and Scoop Jackson's image among Democrats. Ben Wattenberg worked in the Johnson administration and then became a speechwriter for Jackson. He says that Jackson supported both the Johnson and Nixon administration's positions on Vietnam.
His view, and he used to recite it again and again, was that the communists were like burglars walking down the hotel corridor, that they would try each door. And if it was open, they'd go in. If it was closed, they weren't going to bang down. But if it was open, they would go in and take what they wanted.
Tom Foley.
He supported two presidents on Vietnam, but he was not an enthusiastic Vietnam supporter in the sense that he thought in many ways that Vietnam was draining resources and attention from more serious national security problems.
In 1969, at the request of well-known professor Albert Wolfstetter, two young graduate students named Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz came to Washington to write a report about the debate over missile defense then raging in Congress.
Paul and I came to Washington, and among the people we ended up talking to was Scoop Jackson. And Paul and I were both enormously impressed with Scoop. When the week was up, Scoop offered me a job. And he said, why don't you come work for me for a year? You can work on your thesis in your spare time. And I agreed to do that. There was no spare time. I never wrote the thesis. And that was the beginning of 11 years with Scoop.
During the Nixon administration, Jackson would become the most powerful critic of Nixon and Henry Kissinger's policy of détente with the Soviet Union. Richard Pearl says that Jackson opposed détente because he believed that Kissinger underestimated how strong America really was, even in the midst of Vietnam.
I think he had more confidence that we would prevail in the long run and was therefore less willing to make concessions in the short run that he believed would prop them up in the Kremlin.
Over the objections of Kissinger and Nixon, Jackson fought for legislation called the Jackson-Vanik Amendment that made American trade with the Soviet Union dependent on the Soviets' willingness to allow immigration, particularly of Soviet Jews.
Through the mechanism of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, for the first time, he brought into American foreign policy the idea of a quid pro quo on the internal affairs of another country. Sharansky said that the three most important people in the various dissident and Jewish and pro-democracy groups within the Soviet Union were Ronald Reagan, Andrei Sakharov, and Scoop Jackson.
While Jackson pushed for human rights in Russia, he also strongly supported America's geopolitical relationship with China. James Schlesinger sees this as evidence that Jackson was as much a pragmatist as a promoter of democracy.
Back there in the early period, he was a strong supporter of closer relations between the United States and China, which was anything but a democracy. One day he is sitting talking to Deng Xiaoping, and Scoop looked at him and said, "How would China fare under the Jackson-Vanik proposal?" And Deng Xiaoping, with that slight smile that he had, would say, "Oh, I know all about Jackson-Vanik, Senator. How many people would you like from China? 1 million? 5 million? 10 million? At which point, Scoop decided to run up the white flag and change the subject. It reflected, I think, Scoop's basic pragmatism.
Richard Pearl.
No one was ever very comfortable with that view. I think he did, in the interests of what he regarded as a more important strategic goal, which was to deepen the conflict between China and the Soviet Union in order to contain the Soviet Union. I believe in that context he was prepared to overlook the Chinese record on human rights.
In informal polls, Jackson's fellow senators picked him as the senator best qualified to be president of the United States. He ran for the Democratic nomination in 1972 and 1976, but he failed to win both times.
There was, you know, this kind of deprecation of him as a political candidate. Mark Russell said, in repeating the canard of Scoop's dependence on the Jewish community, said that he had put together a wonderful political coalition in support of his candidacy for president, conservative, reform, and orthodox. He also said that if Scoop Jackson made a fireside chat, the fire would go out.
The Carter administration's more dovish view of the Soviet threat alienated Jackson and many of his neoconservative supporters. Frustrated by the Democratic Party, in 1981, many of Jackson's aides and advisors went to work for a Republican administration. Although he was now out of step with his party on many foreign policy issues, Jackson remained a Democrat.
He never thought of changing parties. He thought in terms of rescuing the Democratic Party and bringing it back to what he regarded as the great tradition of the Democratic Party. And that included defending the country physically with a strong national defense and a robust foreign policy.
On September 1st, 1983, the Soviet Union shot down a Korean Airlines passenger jet, killing several hundred civilians. Jackson, then 71 years old, had just returned to his hometown of Everett from a trip to China.
To the end of his life, Henry Jackson was frustrated by the Russians. Ironically, his last public appearance was yesterday to condemn the Soviets' downing of the South Korean airliner.
They apparently have insulted the entire international community by following a barbaric course.
Yesterday's diplomatic crisis wasn't the only thing bothering the 71-year-old senator.
Thank you very much. I've got a cold from the Orient that I'm trying to get rid of, and I didn't think I'd survive this.
A few hours later, he was dead.
Funeral ceremonies were held in Washington, D.C., as well as Jackson's hometown. A year after his death, President Reagan awarded Jackson a posthumous Medal of Freedom.
Henry Jackson absorbed within himself a love of freedom, a will to defend it, and the knowledge that America could not and must not
attempt to float along alone, a blissful island of democracy in a sea of totalitarianism. I'm deeply proud, as he would have been, to have Jackson Democrats serve in my administration.
In the two decades since Jackson's death, many neoconservatives have indeed found a home in the Republican Party, and they have frequently cited Jackson as a source of inspiration. But there is some disagreement about whether Scoop Jackson would have supported the Iraq War and the neoconservatism of today.
This is a kind of compliment to Scoop, I guess, that everybody talks about what Scoop would have thought, what Scoop would have done. You know, it's very hard to know whether Scoop would have supported the war in Iraq or considered it somewhat like Vietnam, a diversion of our resources and capacities that might be needed more urgently elsewhere.
Richard Pearl.
I think, having watched him deal with all kinds of issues over a long period of time, that he would have considered that in responding to 9/11, it was not enough just to go into Afghanistan. I think he would have supported what the president did.
There's an attempt to mold him into something that he would not recognize today. Now, it is perfectly true that there is a strand of Jackson's thought that is sympathetic to some of the things that the neoconservatives stand for. But I believe that Scoop's motives tended to be geopolitical and geostrategic for the most part, that he would have not been a firm believer that we could spread democracy throughout the Middle East.
Regardless of what Jackson might have thought about the Iraq War, Tom Foley believes that the Democratic Party needs more Scoop Jacksons in the post-9/11 world.
Well, they used to be called Jackson Democrats, and they still are in some quarters. The idea of a Jackson Democrat to me means a Democrat who is in strong support of a national security posture of the United States that's second to none in the world, that retains the capacity to defend itself and to defend and support the freedom of others. And at the same time, joined with that as a Jackson Democrat is a support of progressive domestic policies.
I cannot think of another senator other than a president who had that kind of an impact. Here's a guy who was only a powerful senator, died 20 years ago, and people still define themselves as Jackson Democrats, or my hero was Scoop Jackson.
I'm Steve Roberts for America Abroad.
For today's generation of neoconservatives, the Iraq War has been a defining moment that's thrust their views and their perceived influence on policymaking into the limelight. Many opponents of the Bush administration accuse the president of being led blindly into war by the neocons. But neoconservatives take strong issue with that characterization. As America Abroad's Margaret Warner reports, the war in Iraq has revealed the divisions and diversity of views that make up the neoconservative movement.
If there were any doubts about the lightning rod that neoconservatives have become around the world, you could see the electricity crackle during a recent event on Capitol Hill. On May the 17th, British lawmaker George Galloway traveled to Washington to rebut charges by congressional Republicans that he'd profited from Iraq's oil for food program. And then he held a news conference to defend his anti-Iraq war views.
It was a policy that committed infanticide, masquerading as politics. I never got any money. Who are you from? Where are you from? Where are you from? Where are you from? Are you from one of these crazed neocon publications? Are you from? Just tell us who you are and I'll answer you. Will you answer me?
From the Weekly Standard magazine.
The Weekly Standard magazine. I think we'll draw a veil over the Weekly Standard. Yes.
Weekly Standard.
At the Washington, D.C. offices of the Weekly Standard, they're now used to being in the eye of the storm. This small circulation magazine, a lively forum for conservative viewpoints, is now known internationally as well, thanks largely to the links between neoconservatives and the presidency of George W. Bush. But editor-in-chief Bill Kristol, son of Irving Kristol, one of the neoconservative movement's founders, says the president and the neoconservatives have not always considered each other soulmates.
We were hopeful about the Bush administration, but we didn't think, oh, here are the neoconservatives are taking over by any means. And if you look at the first 8 months of the Bush administration, it was a mixed bag. And we were quite critical at the Weekly Standard of some of Bush's policies and quite approving of others. Then September 11th happened.
Bill Kristol believes the attacks of September 11th, 2001, changed the mindset at the White House and led President Bush to see the world through a neocon prism.
I do think the president rethought his own foreign policy then, and he decided that the neoconservative view of the world, the need to project American power, the need to engage in nation-building and peacekeeping and democracy promotion, that these were the solutions to the situation that had caused 9/11.
Bush doctrine, essentially, is a neoconservative response to 9/11.
Neoconservative Washington Post columnist Charles Krauthammer agrees that 9/11 was a turning point for the movement's influence within the administration, not just because it led President Bush to declare a war on terrorism, but because it encouraged him to pursue a much broader agenda in the Middle East.
The liberal response is we have to work with international allies, strengthen treaties, prevent money transfers, and go hunting the terrorists from one cave to another. The neoconservative answer was we have to change the Middle East, which is very radical, very risky, very arrogant, and very problematic. But I have not heard a single better answer to what to do about 9/11 than that. And the fact that we see these enormous sea changes beginning in the Middle East tells you that this was a door that we had to push on, we had to try, we had to do, and it had to start with Iraq.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
The president's decision to go to war with Iraq crystallized in the minds of opponents and allies alike the belief that neoconservatives held sway in the White House, for the war was presented as part of a broader effort to democratize the Middle East. That agenda was expanded even further, says Charles Krauthammer, in the president's second inaugural address, when he pledged that America would wage a global fight against tyranny.
Classic neoconservatism is, to overstate it, would be the president's second inaugural, where we really care who governs and how they govern inside, because the theory is that the method of governance greatly influences, perhaps even determines, the form of their relations with other countries. And that's why the neoconservative idea today is to democratize in the Arab Middle East, Islamic world, as a way to change the method of governance, to change their pedagogy, to change their culture and their propaganda, so that ultimately they will have relations with the United States and their own people will have relations with the United States that will not encourage the kind of hatred, intolerance, and fanaticism that gave us 9/11.
But not all neoconservatives agree that using American military might to forcibly change oppressive regimes is the best way to spread American values or safeguard America's security. Francis Fukuyama is a neocon who famously argued in a 1992 book, The End of History, that the demise of the Soviet Union had forever cemented liberal democracy as the only workable form of government. But in a strong exchange of dueling editorials against Krauthammer last summer, Fukuyama argued that the Bush administration's use of force to advance those aims in Iraq has been counterproductive, causing much of the world to question the legitimacy of America's actions.
My analogy for this is you've got this television set that isn't working. You can't get a picture on it, and you say, well, this thing really isn't working, so let's take a big mallet and whack it as hard as we can on the side in hopes that jars something loose. In a certain number of television sets, it is going to fix the problem, but it's not a very sophisticated way of dealing with something that you see to be a problem. So I think that you could have taken the same principle, that we care about democracy, we want a values-based foreign policy, but realize that, in a sense, you have to hide the kind of hard face of American power. You have to use soft power instruments and a lot of indirection and a little bit more subtlety and nuance in the way that you spread your ideas, because in fact, if you are too heavy-handed about it, you are in fact going to engender this kind of opposition to whatever you do.
So does Fukuyama still consider himself a neoconservative?
Well, I don't know. I suspect I'm probably going to end up getting read out of the movement. But it's okay, because I think the labels get in the way of thinking about these issues creatively.
All this leaves some questioning whether there really is a coherent neoconservative doctrine. Elliot Cohen heads the Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. Often described as a leading neoconservative hawk, Cohen rejects the notion that the Iraq War was the work of neoconservatives.
I was in favor of the Iraq War, but so were a lot of other people. that I know, including many who wouldn't be considered neocons. And I certainly don't see myself as being part of a coherent group of people that has exactly the same view of foreign policy issues.
What's more, Cohen says, neoconservatives have differences on many issues, not just Iraq.
I don't know what the neocon position on dealing with China is. I don't know what the neocon position is on Iran. You know, is it, if you're a neocon, does it mean you're in favor of a preemptive attack on Iran? I know, you know, I think I know some people who might be considered neocons who would say yes, and others who would say no.
Back in the Weekly Standard offices are signs of another time, when neoconservatives clearly had unity of purpose around ousting Saddam Hussein. Framed and proudly hanging on the walls, a Weekly Standard cover from 8 years ago, headlined, "Saddam Must Go, a How-To Guide."
Tell me about this cover, December 1, 1997. Why do you have it displayed here in your waiting room?
Well, we thought Saddam had to go, and we had the Saddam Must Go cover, which has since become famous or infamous, depending on who you talk to. And I'm proud that we played a tiny role in helping persuade people that he had to go. And in fact, if you look at the articles, I think the analysis is pretty good.
Bill Kristol acknowledges that the way in which the Iraq War was prosecuted has revealed some cracks in the neocon camp.
It has caused fissures, because some of us had always been worried that there weren't enough troops, that the administration, especially Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, was not committed to the nation-building task that we needed to be committed to in Iraq, and that therefore the occupation was more difficult than it had to be, and less successful less quickly than it could have been. They do get back to a difference between some who are more interested in going in and getting rid of the bad guys, but more reluctant to then embrace an expansive view of what the U.S. should then do in nation building, peacekeeping, democracy promotion. And some of us who think that when you think it through, you need to embrace that more expansive view.
And Bill Kristol says that today, for better or worse, the fate of neoconservatives in the eyes of the public depends on what happens in Iraq.
This will all ultimately be resolved by reality. These doctrinal fights are interesting, and obviously we all believe in what we believe, but the world is the world, and at the end of the day, you know, we will see who will be proved right.
Which leaves the neoconservatives, as the rest of Americans and the world, with much at stake in Iraq's ultimate success or failure. For America Abroad, I'm Margaret Warner.
Next, is neoconservatism something old, something borrowed, or something new?
Well, I don't think myself that neoconservatism is basically a new direction for American foreign policy.
The impulse toward democracy and towards the set of ideas that are associated with it, I think a lot of those ideas have a very powerful appeal, and they're not going away.
Our roundtable conversation, When America Abroad, continues. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad. We close the program today by looking at the staying power of neoconservatism, by asking what role it might play during the Bush administration's second term and beyond, and by trying to place the movement within the tradition of U.S. foreign policy. The guests for our roundtable discussion, three respected scholars and historians, Professor Ernest May of Harvard University, Professor Marvin Leffler of the University of Virginia, and Professor David Hendrickson of Colorado College. America Abroad's Marvin Kalb started by asking Professor Hendrickson what's new about neoconservatism and its impact on American foreign policy.
Well, I suppose the cardinal elements of its novelty consist in, A, a belief in the necessity of preventive war, B, a confident notion that the United States must, in many circumstances, go it alone, a kind of profound disregard for the constraints imposed by international law and international institutions, a determination to preserve American military superiority.
Professor May, what would be your judgment?
Conservatism, to me, is Burkean, and it's leave things alone. It's, as Stanley Walker once put it, it won't get well if you pick it. And there's this mixture in the neoconservatives of economic conservatism, trust in the market process, and underneath that, distrust of human nature and human mechanisms, but mixed with their inheritance of the long utopian strands, I think, of Woodrow Wilson. I do think there is an affinity between neoconservatism and indeed the Bush foreign policy and Wilson, who felt, as I think President Bush felt when he came into office, that the United States had enormous power, which was a gift of God, and that with that went some kind of responsibility to the rest of the world to use that power for God's purposes.
And Professor Loeffler, the role of God, the idea of America being on a mission, do you find that a consistent theme in neoconservatism?
Yes, I think that is certainly a consistent theme, and I believe that it runs like a thread throughout American history.
I'm not hearing what is distinctly new about neoconservatism. How would you define it?
Well, I don't think myself that neoconservatism is basically a new direction for American foreign policy. The major strands of what we have come to call neoconservatism have been an integral part of American foreign policy for a very long time. One of the most important things I would say about neoconservatism is the enormous emphasis on American values. This emphasis on values is one that I think resonates with very long traditions in American foreign policy. But the larger matrix, I think, of what we've come to call neoconservatism has been around for a long time.
We have neoconservatism now. We're talking about it. But where did we start? With another variant of neoconservatism, if George Washington said, let's not get involved in foreign entanglements, how did the Washington ideas really influence what it is that we see in foreign policy today? Professor Hendrickson.
I guess I wouldn't classify George Washington as a neocon. If one looks back at the complex of thought that's represented by the founders, I think there are a number of important lessons which do speak to the present moment. One of the first axioms of their political science was the belief that power needed to be checked and balanced. Undiluted concentrations of power were, by their very nature, dangerous to freedom. That's one lesson that bears upon this present condition of American hyperpower.
How is history, 20 years from now, going to look back upon the Bush administration and upon neoconservatism in action? Is it going to give it high grades, low grades? What's your judgment, Professor May?
If you look at the intellectual background of the neoconservatives, a lot of them at least have intellectual ancestors who were radicals, in many cases communists, Trotskyites, and so on, people who really were utopians, who then became disillusioned with that utopianism and turned to the idea that didn't work. My guess would be that over some period of time, but whether it's a short period of time or a long period of time, I have no idea, that the same thing will happen with the foreign policy utopianism of the neoconservatives, that it will founder on the fact that, among other things, it costs the lives of soldiers, that it requires a lot of spending of money outside the United States that is going to be unpopular domestically, and that most people will come to think that this utopian agenda also founders on the rock of reality.
And Professor Hendrickson, this idea of the quest for democracy around the world, will it founder?
I don't think it necessarily will. I think that the impulse towards democracy and towards the set of ideas that are associated with it in terms of free societies, I think a lot of those ideas have a very powerful appeal, and they're not going away. I don't think that they need to be forced, as it were, that the attempt to spread them through arms, it seems to me, is very much a misbegotten enterprise and one that does stand athwart the principal beliefs of not only the founders, but also many generations of statesmen who followed them. But the liberal democratic idea is here to stay.
Well, I think the liberal democratic idea is here to stay. How we interpret the legacy of neoconservative foreign policy, I think, will depend a lot on how events evolve in Iraq and in the larger Middle East. I'm not myself prepared to predict how that will come out, but I suspect that many of our attitudes toward neoconservatism will be shaped by the legacy of the intervention in Iraq.
Professor Leffler of the University of Virginia concluding our roundtable discussion, which was chaired by Marvin Kalb. Marvin's other guests were Professor Ernest May of Harvard University and Professor David Hendrickson of Colorado College. And that concludes this edition of America Abroad, The Neocons and America's Foreign Policy. The program is a production of America Abroad Media on the web at www.americaabroadmedia.org. Our executive producer is Aaron Lobel. Our senior producer is Simon Marks. Our director of marketing is Steve Martin. The program was mixed by Robert Frazier. The executive assistant is Heather Campbell. Historical archive came from ABC News, Vanderbilt University Television News Archive, the BBC, the Presidential Audio Archive, Authentic History, Pacifica Radio's Archives, the History Channel Archives, the White House Archives, CNN, Arguing the World with permission by Joseph Dorman, MSU Vincent Voice Library, British Pathé, the Free Speech Movement Digital Archive, and the Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan Presidential Libraries. We had production assistance from Laura Iyama, Essen Erkin, Jerome Netter, Chris Williams, Safiya Alkarsa, and Noura Siddiqui. Along with Marvin Kalb, Margaret Warner, Steve Roberts, and Garrick Utley, I'm Ray Suarez. Join me next time for another edition of America Abroad.
Support for this program comes from the Ford Foundation, the Draper Richards Foundation, The Economist, and the Star Foundation. Support also comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Today's programming.